behind me wasn't really singing, right? That was our choir doing one of those Zoom virtual choirs, which is quite a feat. So I think John and John Johnson, who mixes it, and Mary Kerrigan and David Kerrigan, who put it all together, I think they deserve an extra round of applause, because it's really quite an accomplishment. So my talk today is about a spiritual solution to the problem of good and evil. I thought I'd pick something really easy for for Father's Day, something that I can easily explain that everybody will understand in, oh, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes, and then, oh, that's what it is. Okay, now I can go on with my life. But actually, the reason that I picked it is that the concept of good and evil is very much in front of our face all of the time right now, with just having her in the process of going through a pandemic that is still sketchy. We still don't exactly know what it's going to do. That's why, by the way, we're not expanding the numbers of the church for a while. We could technically fit more people in here and still be in compliance, but we're just kind of waiting to see what the numbers are going to do before we start inviting in more folks, just to be safe. So there's that, there's the pandemic, and then there's all of this racial unrest that's been coming up, and injustice that has been exposed, and the economy, and so many things that seem to get our attention, and I think cause many of us to ask, is there evil in the world? And you know, perhaps folks that are in this tradition or that are not well schooled in this tradition might even say, why does God allow bad things to happen? Why does God allow evil? So we're going to take a little a look at that and see if there's a reason, and if there is, what can we do about it? Last week, I spoke about how I want to be better. I spoke a lot about understanding racism, and I just at the end of the service said, you know, it's not like us in religious science to say this, because we're always affirming that we're whole, perfect, and complete, but right now, I just want to be better. And part of that being better involves, for me, educating myself on racism and watching movies and watching documentaries and listening to speakers and understanding more about the conditions in the world. So this week, I attended a webinar with two social justice leaders, John Powell and Meg Wheatley. John Powell is a black professor at UCal, Berkeley, Cal Berkeley. And Meg Wheatley has written many, many books on leadership. And, you know, it was so interesting because they're both renowned leaders in their field, and yet they couldn't really agree on much. They had the same goal, but they had very, very different perspectives on that same goal and very different ways of going about getting to that place. They wanted justice and equality, but their approaches were so different. Now, honestly, I resonated more with John Powell because he seemed to be hopeful, whereas Meg Wheatley was saying more like, no, we can't reinvent the world. It has to collapse first. And maybe true, but I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing. You know, maybe some structures need to be torn down before things get built up. But there was a sort of a pessimism about her and an optimism about John, and I'm very much in the optimism camp, probably because of this teaching and what we teach here. So some of the information that was shared on that will come up later in this talk, but I just wanted to point out that even in the concept of good and evil and what's to do and what's right and what's wrong, people that are renowned in their field have completely different opinions about what to do, and that's part of the issue. So in terms of solving the problem of good and evil, of looking at it, I turn to Joel Goldsmith. Now, how many of you folks here in the live audience are familiar with Joel Goldsmith? Oh, quite a few. So if you're not, he is kind of like a hardcore metaphysical teacher. He's one of the greats. And I actually really like his stuff, because he's one of the first people that's introduced me to the concepts of non-duality that I understand a lot better now that I've read other non-dual teachers. So for this month, I'm reading, and if you care to join me, reading a book called The Government of Eden, which is where the reading was from that Hugh did. And in this, it's a compilation of essays by Joel Goldsmith that was compiled especially for this time. as a lot of things are shifting, as a lot of things are changing, and as a lot of stuff is getting stirred up. Now, it's for this time, but Joel Goldsmith didn't write it at this time, did he? Because he passed away a while ago. So we can see that there have been cycles of good and evil throughout, or the appearance of good and evil throughout centuries and centuries. And I think this is supposed to be helpful for us to realize that, but also to inspire us to think and to dream that maybe something greater can be in store for us, that this is a shifting of an age, and that maybe we can have a dream of something wonderful for all beings. When I was on the call with John Powell, he said, you know, there's a reason that Martin Luther King said, I have a dream. He didn't say, I have a plan, I have an agenda, I have a to-do list. He said, I have a dream. John Powell spoke about a Richard Pryor comedy, although it's not really very funny, a comedy sketch that he did, because Richard Pryor was one of the first black comedians to start to really draw attention to the situation that many black people were living in the relationship with the police and all that. And John said that in this skit, Richard Pryor was being sentenced for a crime that he didn't do. And he was being sentenced by a judge, and the judge gave him the sentence, and he asked Richard Pryor, do you have anything to say? And he said to the judge, because judge, you've taken away my family, my livelihood, my health, my well-being, my home, and my dignity. And the judge said, well, you got any dreams? Can I have those too? You see how it's not really funny? Right? Because we need a dream. We absolutely need a dream. That, again, that is why Martin Luther King said, I have a dream, not a plan, not an agenda, not a to-do list. We need a dream of a greater world, a world where we can understand that good and evil is not a necessity, but that it is optional, and that both conditions are human-made. So let me explain a little bit about that. So Joel Goldsmith, this hardcore metaphysician, talks about the ideas of good and evil. And so I don't forget, I'm going to look at my little notes here. Yes, so Joel Goldsmith says that the spiritual solution to good and evil, or to the presence of evil, the problem is there because of a belief in two powers, a power for good and a power for evil, that are equally powerful, whereas really evil is just the absence of good. He talks about how in the Garden of Eden, the allegory of the Garden of Eden, that Adam and Eve got in trouble when they ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And they were naked and they were ashamed. And God says to them, who told you you were naked, right? You would think they wouldn't need to be told, but he said, what that means really is, who told you that you were naked and that was a reason for shame? So in that moment, in that metaphorical moment of eating of good and evil, eating the tree of knowledge of good and evil, something emerged, this duality emerged where we start to judge and criticize and categorize, and that is what gets us in trouble. Clinging to the good, pushing away the evil, clinging to the good, resisting the evil, that is what gets us into a state of trouble. So Joel Goldsmith urges us to lay aside labeling things as evil and also to lay aside labeling things as good. And you may say, well, what's there to do then? But it's a matter of realizing that everything just is. There is an isness to being, and that isness is good beyond good. It is good beyond good, and that good beyond good is what we identify with and what we resonate with and what gets us through and what we anchor in whenever we're going to do something that requires us to stretch and to dream and to have a bigger, bolder vision for humanity. He says that the perception of evil is highly relative, which means that it's not absolute. He suggests in his book that you ask somebody, or you think about somebody that you really don't like, Anybody have anybody? No. No need to shout out any names or anything. You think about somebody that you really don't like, and then you wonder, well, what does their mother think about them? Does their mother like them? Maybe, maybe not. But for every person that we don't like, somebody likes them. So who's right? Is a person likable or not likable? The answer, of course, is yes. But the likability and the unlikability is not coming from that person. It is coming from our perception of that person. And the same thing is true with evil. This is hard to say because people think that it's being disrespectful and it's being cavalier about the evil in the world. But it's not that evil in the world isn't happening. It's that we're giving it too much false power. We need to look at how the evil in the world is constructed, and much of the evil in the world is made up by human minds. You know, last week I spoke about how Ishwar Dada in India, in the land of Gandhi, got in trouble. He was in an elite class, and he touched a broom, and they said, well, now you're an untouchable because you touched a broom, right? That's making stuff up. When I was listening to John, I was reminded, John Powell on the call, I was reminded of something that I had edited for him years ago, and it was a story about how racism was born in part in the U.S. And what he talked about was that when there were crops that needed to be grown, particularly in the South, that there were groups of people like the Native Americans and some of the white folks that were in the South that were not able to tolerate the heat and the work, and that they were prone to diseases. And he said, unfortunately for the Africans, they were able to tolerate the work and the heat, and they weren't particularly prone to the diseases that Americans might give them or British people might give them. And then there were other people in Africa, other tribes in Africa that thought, my tribe is good and your tribe is bad, so we're going to sell your tribe into slavery. We're going to give you away and have you go to America. So this is going on all over the place, people making a decision about who is bad and who is good. So the elite class got African slaves, but they also had white workers as well, white workers that were on a lower sort of social strata. They were poor. And what happened, according to John, was that the white workers and the black workers started getting together and opposing the elite. And so the elite planted a seed and said, you know what? You white people are better than those other people. And that's where a lot of racial tension was born in the U.S. And you see how it's made up. You see how it's contrived. And then you see also how generations have bought into this as reality. Generations have decided that this is the truth. Generations have had consequences because of the belief in this truth. You know, and it's that thing, race consciousness that we talk about. That means the human race consciousness. It is a collectively held belief that everybody buys into and everybody thinks it's true. And one of the challenges with race consciousness is that once you see it, it is really hard to unsee. Once you see a falsehood, it is, and believe it to be true, it is hard to unsee. Anybody ever have trouble unseeing something? I'm thinking about nursing. I'm thinking about walking on the dog with my beach and on the beach rather, walking on the dog with my beach. No, walking on the beach with my dog and seeing him consume a whole chunk of blubber. Yeah. It was gross. He was carrying it around, and he was so proud of it. I thought, oh, let the young lad carry the blubber. He likes it. Next thing I know, he's eating it. I'm like, no, no, can't unsee that. Rupert Spira, in one of his videos, talks to a woman about how she was looking at a painting, and the painting was just a streak of color, and she just felt so connected to the streak of color. She thought it was so beautiful, and then she looked at the title of the painting, and it said, a kimono. And she looked at the painting again and tried really hard to find that kimono, and then she saw the kimono in the painting. And then every time she looked at the painting, she didn't see just a beautiful streak of color. She saw a kimono, and she couldn't unsee it. And they used that in this Rupert Spira conversation about what we do with reality. We say, ah, here is a label for this. I am going to name this. This is good. This is evil. This is wrong. This is right. And we decide upon that, and then we can't see anything else. Particularly when we are with like-minded people or when we listen to like-minded news media, we get ourselves into an echo chamber where we can never see other perspectives. And it's a wonderful thing to recognize that we are making stuff up all the time and calling it reality. Would you mind repeating after me? I make up stuff all the time. And I call it reality. And I'm going to try and do better from now on. I hope the people at home were saying it too. It's pretty funny. You know, when you're used to having a bigger group, although I'm getting kind of fond of this small group here. It's fun. Anyway, I digress. So that's what we're doing all the time. And what if we were to challenge that? What if we were to look at where we are, just riveted to our opinion of what something needs to be or what something is? And what if we were able to just say, you know what? I'm going to do a little reality with a big R check. Reality with a big R. Absolute reality check on that. I'm going to see if that's really, really the way of good beyond good. I'm going to see if that's God's vision. I'm going to see if that's love's vision. And if there's duality in it, chances are it is not. I'm going to read you something that Joel Goldsmith says. He suggests that every day we wake up and we say, and this is long. I'll read the short part that you might remember, and then I'll post the other someplace. He says, every day that we wake up, we should say, I will not know good or evil. I know only God as good beyond good. I threw in the beyond good myself. I will not know good or evil. I will know only God as good beyond good. And then he says, I will begin a daily practice every time some person seems to dominate, whether in the family life or the community life, national or international, we go through a daily practice of saying, aha, I am not to be fooled by appearances. There is no power given unto the human. All power is in God. All power is in the spirit. All power is in the invisible. And those who show forth good are showing forth the presence and power of God, of good beyond good. Those who are showing forth evil are showing forth the arm of flesh or nothingness, and its power over us has been our fear of it, our fear of it, our acceptance of two powers, our lack of understanding that God, that love, is the only power. Ah, it's a powerful thing. It's a powerful thing. And yes, I acknowledge that it is hard to get your hands around that, to get your mind around that, to get your heart around that when really bad things are happening in the world. It is hard to acknowledge that. But what if we were just to try it? Just to try it and see what happens. What if we were to just try and say, you know what, I'm going to release my judgment on this. I'm going to surrender to God. Only God is God. There is no God but God. Borrowing from the Christian tradition and the Islamic tradition. Only God is good. Only God is God. There is no God but God. So we're not to make a false God out of good, out of material good. We're not to make a false God out of material evil. We are not seeking greater matter. We are seeking the kingdom of heaven. And the kingdom of heaven is the consciousness of belief in one power. One power. It discards the notion of two equal powers, and it believes in one power. That, my beloved congregation, is the kingdom of heaven. Preach it, girl. Preach it. Yeah. Yeah. Amen and hallelujah. Okay. So it's one thing to know it. It's one thing to know it. Do you know it? Are you feeling it at all? You feeling that there's one power? One power for good? Do I have to jump up and down? Not wearing really the right equipment for jumping so much. But anyway, thank you. I'm glad we caught that on film. There is one power for good, and we feel that, and we know it, but then we have to do something about it, don't we? Because I feel like I say this almost every week. I'm repeating myself. Get used to it. this is me. This is Bonnie OneNote, like Johnny OneNote. This is all there is to do, is to know that there is one power for good, but then we have to live like the truth is true. We have to act like we actually believe it. Even if we don't, we might have to take a risk and act like and say the inner dialogue of what it is to believe in only one power for good. What would that be like? What would that be like? Would that change our vision? Would that change our relationships with people? Would that change our lives if we looked at all of the subtleties where we're believing in two powers and then say to ourselves, nope, I'm releasing that belief in two powers. I am no longer clinging to material good. I am no longer rejecting material evil. I am grounding myself and anchoring myself in the power of one. The power of one power that is good beyond good, because this is God and I am one with God and I am remembering who I am. That's what y'all say. That's what I'm going to say. I'm going to work on that until I forget. And then I'm hoping one of you, or you, will remind me. Because we will forget. So we have to get into a practice of it. We have to get into a regular practice. John Powell talked about how, and he was the hopeful one on the call, he talked about how much of the trouble in the world, whether it's between black folks and white folks or other races that are warring against each other, or the LGBTQ community with, yay, Supreme Court, thank you. Got it right. But much of the trouble is through othering. He uses the word othering. This person is not one with me. This person is other. And he says that the contrast for othering is belonging. And so in terms of living in this oneness and affirming with our bodies and with our energy and with our beings, living like the truth is true, the word becoming flesh, the word of oneness becoming flesh and dwelling among us, what if we were to practice belonging or ensuring that others felt like they were belonging? What if we were to look past differences in ideology, in skin color, in methodologies, in orientation, in all things? It doesn't mean you have to agree with the person, it just means we have to respect it and say, you know what? We're different, but we still belong. We're still one human family. And as you know, again, broken record, Bonnie OneNote. You know that song, right? Johnny OneNote. Do you know that song? It's David singing it through a mask. What I heard was, it was beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, there's my ATM. My ATM is back, my factoid ATM. Okay. The way to manifest the spirit of belonging is through acts of kindness. Of course. It's what she says every freaking Sunday. It's acts of kindness. That is what we do. And you know why? Because another person that I listened to this week, Bryan Stevenson, the African-American man, the black man that Just Mercy, the movie, was based on, I listened to a lecture of his that he gave in a church that was sensational. Oh my goodness, I really recommend that everybody listen to it. And he talked about how some of the things that we need to do to overcome this divide between ourselves, white people and black people, between really any groups that are othering the other, is to practice proximity. To go into places where you wouldn't normally go and relate to people that you wouldn't normally relate to. And it's not limited to race, it's limited to whoever you disdain, basically. If you disdain someone, that might be your calling card to become their friend. And it may not have to do with any of the big issues like, social issues or race or orientation or political ideology. It may be, I just don't like the way that person treats me, or I just don't like that person's not a vegetarian. How could we possibly be friends? I am married to someone who's not a vegetarian, so I can tell you that it is possible and we are very good friends. So it's just It's just a matter of seeing who you're calling other and then putting yourself proximal to them. Because the other thing that he says is that we have to be willing to tolerate discomfort. Does anybody here love discomfort? Okay, if you're home, raise your hand. Put it on the. Oh, look, Cheryl loves discomfort. Yay. Yeah. Because, you know, at some point, I remember Michael Beckwith saying, and I quote this a lot, Michael Beckwith said that he learned to love the feeling of uncertainty. And I certainly, through the pandemic, and possibly others of us too, have kind of gotten interested in the idea of uncertainty as a way of life. Because if we're certain, again, we're drawing a box around reality, and something even greater can happen. You know, when these two people were speaking on the call, the one that was negative in her view, and the positive one, John, they were talking about apartheid. And John was saying, you know, he worked in South Africa with the folks that were trying to bring about equal rights for black people, trying to liberate the black folks down there. And he said they were just desperate. They just felt like it was not going to happen in their lifetime. And then while they weren't looking, something shifted, and it did happen. Now, the other one said, well, it's not perfect yet. I mean, there's still lots of inequity and inequality and the rights aren't. But John's like, no, see, that's not the point. It's like you just keep doing it. You're not attached to the outcome. You just keep pushing in the right direction. You keep striving in the right direction. You keep opening up your heart to bigger possibilities. And, you know, if race or the politics or whatever it is doesn't do it for you, I can guarantee that there are so many opportunities in all of our lives where we can practice belonging and where we can practice moving in that direction of belief in only one power. But it is going to take a little bit of discomfort, and discomfort is a beautiful thing. Let's all fall in love with discomfort. Let's all fall in love with discomfort. Let's send it a Valentine. Let's take it out for dinner. Let's let's just all fall in love with discomfort. You know, I think I need another show of hands in just a moment. How many of you, when you get ready to do an act of kindness, do you sometimes talk yourself out of it? Yeah, that's a show of hands. That's good. So Lisa has her pinky up. That's a good show of pinkies. Yes, if you're too embarrassed to admit that, just raise your pinky and we won't know. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I know that pretty much every time I do it, particularly if it's something bold, I have excuses why I shouldn't do it. And that's the opposite of what I'm saying. That is me not practicing what I preach, because I don't want to be uncomfortable. I don't want to be vulnerable. I'm afraid how the person will receive it. I have a whole litany of excuses why I won't do the act of kindness. And I have to tell you, every time I'm able to put that litany aside and just go with the first instinct to be kind, and I don't always do that. Sometimes I shut it down. But when I'm able to go with the first instinct to be kind, I have absolutely never, ever regretted that choice. Never. Even if it's not well received, there's some learning in just the act of giving it. The act of giving it, even when the person doesn't necessarily want it. I tried to give food to a homeless person one time and he wasn't homeless, so there's that. He didn't really want it. That was a long time ago. So if anything, I hope that what you've gotten from this is that I believe that it is possible to change the world and to create a better world. But it happens not necessarily. I mean, certainly policies need to be changed, but in that reading that Hugh said, it's not as much about the policies as it is about the change in our consciousness. You know, and there are people that are experts in policies that would disagree with that. There are people and experts that say, well, that's just airy-fairy, kumbaya, let's braid each other's hair. But I know that this is true. I know this with my whole being, that the work of this civilization right now is other things, but our work, though the faithful, those who are not godless heathens, sorry. No, okay. I said that because I refer to myself as a godless heathen whenever I go to this group that has a lot of Christians, and I'm like, here comes the godless heathen, because I have a very different version of God than they do. But anyway, so talk about proximity, right? Proximity and belonging, and it's not totally comfortable, but I'm doing it, man, and it's good. It's been awesome. Those of us who are the faithful, it is our sworn responsibility to do this work, to recognize the one power beyond the appearance of two opposites, to inhabit Rumi's field, to love completely, to love unconditionally, to refrain from attaching too much to good and to resisting evil, but just to stay in that center place where we are aligned and identified with the great I Am presence, which is the truth of all beingness. One closing comment. When I was listening to the call with John, he asked us, does anybody know who the rulers were in Jesus' time? Herod, maybe, but there's some discrepancy about when Herod actually died. I'm not making eye contact with David Kerrigan because he could probably tell me. Herod and others. There haven't been a lot of movies or books written about Herod or others. But when you say Jesus, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, the entire world has been affected by the teachings of Jesus. And it wasn't that he was politically savvy. It was that he undermined the social structures that were in place by loving those who were in the margins and defying the current authority of two powers, the authority of these people are good and these people are not good, I am good and you're not good, or I'm bad and you're good. He undermined that authority, but most of all, he just loved. And that's what I'm calling for us for today, what I'm calling forth, complete unconditional love. And complete unconditional love means willingness to look past our biases and ask God. If we can't figure out what to do, ask God, please, Spirit, change me into someone who can love unconditionally in this moment. Please, Spirit, change me into someone who can see this differently. Please, Spirit, change me into someone that aligns with your will always. Let's do that now, and let us pray.